This is a Pinball News production.
I want to thank you very much for that kind introduction and apologize to you folks at the outset here that I'm going to have to give this presentation with my back to you. I'm a prisoner of my own low-tech presentation, so bear with me, but I'm delighted you were able to join me today, and I hope you'll enjoy this presentation. The presentation is entitled George Melenton's Artwork in the Golden Age of Pinball, a.k.a. Pinball by George. I'd like to thank Michael Sheese, founder and executive director of the Pacific Pinball Museum, Larry Zartarian, chairman of the PPM, and the rest of the Pacific Pinball Museum board for once again inviting me to speak here. I'd also like to thank my wife, Pat Shannon, who was the co-owner of that collection, who is here today but can't be with us. She's unfortunately sick in bed. I wanted to thank her publicly for abiding my passion for all these years, but we'll have to forgo that for the moment. But today I'd like to share with you the work of the most prolific artist in pinball history, my late friend George H. Melenton. George was born on the 17th of August, 1913, and passed away on September the 10th, 1994. For nearly 50 of his 81 years, he worked as an artist in the coin-operated amusement industry, devoting most of his time and effort to creating pinball artwork. He began his career in 1932 as a freelance artist working for David Rockola for the Exhibit Supply Company, and for the Exhibit Supply Company. Shortly thereafter, he joined Advertising Posters, one of the two primary silkscreen companies providing artwork to the games industry. When he retired as art director at Ad Posters 5 decades later, he had left an indelible impression on an entire industry. Melenton's work adorned and brought to life more coin-operated amusement games than any other artist in history. Sadly, today, among the public at large, his astonishing body of work is largely unknown. But George's brilliant work during the immediate post-war years, along with the other giant of pinball art, Leroy Parker, defined what is today recognized as the Golden Age of pinball. And pinball's Golden Age was an important ingredient in America's Golden Age of popular culture and conspicuous consumption, the 1950s. Pinball was as much a part of the iconography of that special time as hot rods, jukeboxes, 3D, drive-in movies, and rock and roll idols. During the period from 1946 through 1954, newfound affluence and increased leisure time led to the development of some of the most beautiful and carefully designed pinball games ever produced. Games that were often played to death and are now coveted by serious collectors for their superior artwork, design, and entertainment value. The pinball artwork of the time was a mirror that reflected back to the lower middle class 10 to 20-year-old man-child, the primary player of that day, an ideal world that he longed to inhabit. Consequently, the imagery is full of visual references to travel and exotic destinations, sporting events and games of chance, dancing, shows, nightclubs, all the material trappings of the good life and the ever-present and seductive lure of delicious Melenton and Parker girls. You might ask why it's of value from an historical perspective to give pinball graphics serious consideration as a legitimate form of commercial art. Well, for openers, pinball is totally visual and highly effective as both an attract mode and a storytelling vehicle. The graphics are unique, closely allied to circus and carnival art, not to mention the fact that pinball is quintessentially American. What's more, pinball graphics are perfectly suited to today's nostalgic mood, our widespread yearning for simpler, better times. And pinball is fun, which of course is self-evident. Finally, from time to time, pinball could be just a little bit rude, which simply adds an extra fillip to its enduring appeal. Although the game themes were almost infinitely varied, the intended result was always the same: to provide the player with a pleasant break from limited prospects and the tedious grind of day-to-day reality to provide a nickel escape, a five-cent fantasy. Let's explore where some of George's fantasy visions took his players of the 1950s. Hop off the streetcar, grab a bourbon and branch. Wind your way through the cruise in the French Quarter, drenched in streamers, doubloons and balloons, past the clowns, harlequins, and streetwalkers. Stiltwalkers. Sorry about that, folks. Hope there are no children in the room. It's raining. You can see where my head is. It's raining confetti in the Crescent City under the gas lamps, and it's all for you. The bells, the balls, and later the parties. Hand-walking clowns and knee-walking drunks. Tomorrow comes early. But for the moment, there's Cajun cooking, Dixie beer, and a ballerina with a face like Monroe. Everyone had wanted to call this game Mardi Gras. But competitive game manufacturer Genco had used that name just 4 months earlier, in 1948. So Melanton and the Williams team settled on Domino. The half mask worn by so many of the revelers in this final night of celebration before the dawn of Shrove Tuesday and the abstinence of Lent. Now just for fun, let's take a look at how another artist handled a gala street event. In this case, a pregame college football parade. Here's Williams' majorettes from April 1952 with art by Leroy Parker for Williams? Well, it's true. On occasion, Parker did work for game makers other than Gottlieb. In addition to majorettes, he did the artwork for Williams' May 1952 Olympics, August 1956 Funhouse, and September 1956 Perky. But let's leave our homecoming parade in the streets of New Orleans for the canvas tents of the Big Top, for the changing room of three beautiful acrobats captured by Melanton and Williams in February 1951 Shoo Shoo. In dramatic contrast to Leroy Parker's women, Melanton's women are at once more real and yet more romantic. George had the eye, the brush, and the palette of a fashion illustrator, while Parker was definitely a graduate of the pinup school. According to an interview my friend, the late Rush Jensen, conducted with Harry Williams, Shoo Shoo was the name of one of Harry's dogs, presumably a toy or miniature breed. Shoo Shoo is a typically fun Williams Golden Age game with lots of features, reverse flippers, a tilt reset, and almost as many bells as balls, four to be exact. Beautiful as Shoo Shoo is, George may have done his best work in the circus genre on Harry Williams' very first game of original manufacture, Suspense, from February 1946. First the broadsides, then the big parade, tigers, elephants, lions and bands, like some returning Roman legion, the captured and fallen spared for Caesar's pleasure. Elephants and roustabouts pitch the giant tent. Peanuts, popcorn, cotton candy. Then, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, as high above the center ring, an Amazon beauty, both handsome and bold, dismisses the danger of death in the sawdust and works without a net. This Melanton tribute to the American circus, filled with post-war exuberance, is particularly appropriate as a pinball theme. For suspense is the very essence of pinball, translated here in visual terms as an aerial act of grace, skill, and ever-present danger. A pleasing metaphor for the player's own heroic struggle with the silver ball, his own intensely personal greatest show on earth. In this beautiful back glass, Melanton reveals his mastery of a whole host of artistic disciplines: perspective, anatomy, drama, light and shadow, and his extraordinary talents as a colorist. George worked for lots of pinball makers during his career, not just Williams. He did bingo and amusement machines for both Bally and United. He also worked for Exhibit Supply until they left the pinball business forever in January of 1951. And when they left in January 51, it was with a beautiful game called Trigger, a seldom seen game that features a Melanton back glass with an Old West cowboy astride a bucking bronco. But a little over 3 years earlier than that, George had created this October 1947 Western masterpiece for United. Horse sale today, barbecue too, and buckaroos arrive in brand new Packards, 10-gallon hats, money in their jeans, and Hank Williams crackling on the radio. Most of the mines are closed now, but Hoover Dam's built, the war is won, and there are lots of good horses in the Silver State, good women too. And who's got neon 30 feet tall in the middle of the desert? Except us. Melentin's work here shows the intrusion of the automobile into an environment historically dominated by the horse. In fact, his artwork is very reminiscent of Fred Cole's immortal 1923 ad for the Jordan motor car somewhere west of Laramie. Like the ad itself, Melentin suggests the confrontation of the auto culture with the older, more traditional one, and hints at a new and not necessarily better future. The car depicted was probably based on the 1948-49 model year Packard Custom 8 convertible, the first open car made in America after the war. Following Nevada in 47, Melentin did artwork for Oklahoma and Utah in 49, then Yuma, Arizona in 1950, followed by Rodeo, a United Bingo in 53, and their Nevada Bingo in 1954. A quick look at United's 1949 Oklahoma reveals one of Melentin's signature devices, the close-up of a woman's face in the foreground of the back glass. You saw it earlier on Domino, and you'll see it again on Ragmop, Screamo, and on this glass, United's November 1948 Wisconsin. These close-ups give George's back glass a great sense of immediacy, a snapshot kind of realism. They also display the artist's confidence in rendering the difficult human face. Now take a good look at the beautiful glass George did for Screamo in March of 1954. Elevated trains with 80-foot drops, brightly painted ponies that never pulled a load, food you don't smell in row house kitchens, cotton candy, popcorn, hot dogs, too. There are shooting gallery murders, funhouse terrors, machines with no purpose but to keep you amused, and crowds of happy, friendly people in a city reinvented to run on fun. This is Chicago's Riverview Park, which entertained millions in the city's northwest side, shown here at the height of its popularity. It closed forever in 1967, just 2 years before its East Coast counterpart, Palisades Park. A descendant of the trolley parks of the previous century, Riverview was one of the last and grandest of the traditional pre-Disney, pre-theme parks that we know today. Like most amusement parks in working-class cities, Riverview was greatly loved by the people of Chicago. And Melentin's portrait here is a fitting tribute to that affection. Among the attractions he features here are some of the park's most popular, including the Bob's roller coaster with its 85-foot first drop, the parachute jump, Aladdin's castle, and other roller coasters that were in operation at Riverview during the 54 season included the Silver Flash, the Blue Streak, the Greyhound, and yes, the Comet, which many of you will recognize from a much later game. If you like the roller coaster theme of Screamo, it's one of the best. But don't miss Keeney's High Ride from 1947, Gottlieb Sitting Pretty from 1958, or Williams' more recent Cyclone and Comet. While working-class folks in the 50s had to find their pleasure in nearby attractions like amusement parks, bars, and social clubs, their more affluent counterparts became the first wave of globetrotters. As late as the early 1970s, the majority of Americans had still not flown in an airplane, staggering but true. So it's easy to understand how romantic the notion of air travel was for the average citizen of the 1950s. Airports at the time were relatively quiet, civilized places. People dressed in their finest clothes when they flew, and stewardesses were still required to be registered nurses. Williams' March 1951 control tower, shown here, is probably Melentin's tribute to Chicago's Midway Airport, in its day the busiest in the world. It's also, in my opinion, one of the most beautiful back glasses ever done. Props humming as they lap the air, and the sky ablaze with color just for us. Chicago's our horizon, just a toy town now, the way we see it here from the special place of ours. Crowds? Heavens no. For others, there are trains, buses. Only the wealthy fly or the desperate. Why, we'll be in Paris before you're up for work. Perhaps because so many of the games made during pinball's golden age were played in the dark corners of questionable establishments, game manufacturers of the day brightened those venues for their players with visions of sun-drenched destinations and faraway places. In November of 1947, George captured some of the island charm of Bermuda in this glass for Chicago coin. Every major pinball maker but Gottlieb created their own stable of exotic destination games during the Golden Age, and Chicago coin was no exception. Following Bermuda, they released Catalina, Trinidad, Shanghai, and Tahiti, all with artwork by George Melenton. And while the young men who played these games would likely never get to the destination shown, it mattered little. They could still drool over George's jackknifing or bicycling beauties, cavorting here in pre-moped Bermuda, and be captivated by the gameplay on Bermuda, the first ever Chicago coin pinball with those newfangled flippers. Here George offers us a glimpse of the Eiffel Tower on Exhibit Supply Company's Mamzelle from August of 1947. It may take you a while to bring the tower into focus, since Mamzelle herself dominates our view. Note that the score topped out at 400,000 as opposed to the typical 7 and 9 million on later games by Gottlieb and Williams, respectively. Take a look at one more fantasy tableau as Melenton transports us to Morocco on the back glass of Williams' Caravan from June 1972. But even in the world of pinball, it wasn't all fun and games. From June 30th, 1950 until July 27th, 1953, a United Nations police action, a.k.a. the Korean War, was taking place. In 1951, blues singer Charles Brown lamented the war in his mournful ballad, Black Night. And in August 1952, George Melenton made it the subject of this game, Paratrooper. It's a very, very dramatic departure for a game from this period, but its unique jump ball feature makes it loads of fun to play. We had wanted to put the Paratrooper from my collection on the floor of the expo this year, but fortunately we couldn't get it working properly. Anyway, for the most part, George's fantasy visions were a lot more comforting and a lot closer to home, as they are here in Williams' 1954 QT. Wasp-waisted and full-sweatered, Earth Angel, will you be mine? Gliding across those linoleum squares in your open-toed shoes as you run the table, wielding your stick like a willy hoppy. Drop another nickel in the jukebox, babe, I hear you say as I push D2, then turn to watch as you bank the eight ball and hustle Archie Andrews for a 7-ounce Coke. In this typical 50s teenage hangout, a pool table is substituted for the more expected jukebox or pinball machine to accommodate the game's billiard theme. Here, Parker's cartoon characters, his Letterman, lounging in the booth in the background, are simply comic foils for his voluptuous co-eds, a convention that gives the scene the wholesome flavor of an Archie comic book and lets the player know that he has no real competition for the ladies' attentions. Seems like America's typical teenagers were on everyone's mind at the time, for in June 1954, just a month before QT was released, Bill Gaines's mad comic book published Starchy, a savage parody of Archie in those waning pre-code days before Dr. Frederick Wortham, the Kefauver hearings, and the resulting censorship that all but eviscerated the comic book industry. Let's take another look at how George portrayed the idealized teen scene on Williams' Rag Mop from October 1950. My first encounter with a rag mop was in the bedroom of a grade school classmate of mine. I can still remember how shocked I was as a 9 or 10-year-old to see a real pinball machine in a private home, let alone a bedroom. Little did I know. When George did the artwork for Rag Mop, popular music was in an awkward period that was post-big band and pre-rock and roll. His inspiration was the popular tune Rag Mop, backed by Sentimental Me, a double-sided hit for the Ames Brothers. Record stores in those days were still mom-and-pop neighborhood operations where you could go into a soundproof booth, listen to a record, and decide whether or not you wanted to buy it. But things were changing fast. RCA had introduced the 45 RPM vinyl single in 1949, and popular tunes were hovering in a musical limbo. The Ames Brothers had achieved fame after a spectacular appearance at one of vaudeville's last strongholds, the Roxy Theater in New York City. Incidentally, its most famous member, Ed Ames, went on to play the Native American Mingo on TV to Fess Parker's Daniel Boone. By 1956, rock and roll would reign supreme, but during this uncertain time period, popular music was still dominated by vocalists and musicians who had come out of the big swing and dance bands of the 30s and 40s. Casting about for new musical directions often led to unusual contrasts, as it did here, where musicians from the dying big band tradition on the right provide the beat for a strange combination of jitterbug and swing steps on the left. George was a master at creating a sense of time and place that took his youthful players on fantasy excursions. Here we find ourselves pleasure cruising under the flag of Williams Colors from August 1954, with not a man in sight, not even a steward or a deckhand to distract our player from this bevy of Melanton beauties. And from time to time, George indulged in pure fantasy, as he did here in Williams' March 1955, Peter Pan. The theme, of course, was based on J.M. Barrie's 1904 novel. Mary Martin played the title role on Broadway and in a TV special on NBC's Producers Showcase. Now, do you think it was mere coincidence that This Machine was released the same month that Mary Martin's special aired? Disney had made Peter Pan into an animated feature in 1952, and Martin and actor Cyril Richard brought it back to center stage on Broadway and with two successive broadcasts of the TV staging. Even though George Melanton was an avid sailor, he must have been a bit put off at having to paint mermaids here instead of real women, for echoing the frustration of sailors down through the ages, the trouble with mermaids is they're not enough fish to eat and not enough woman to love. Before we move on, please notice the three-reeled replay meter on Peter Pan, which also appeared on Colors. Williams made a handful of games in the mid-50s with special features that awarded up to 100 replays at a time. These games were also equipped with knockoff buttons so the location owner could quickly remove the free games won and reward the player with a cash payoff. The gambling ethic clearly died hard in pinball. George lived and worked in Chicago, so it was inevitable that he chose the Windy City, so named for the bluster of its politicians rather than the strength of its lake breezes, as the subjects of some of his artwork. June of 1956 finds us here at the busy intersection of Balls and Played, with one of George's famous pinups gracing a local billboard, and the Williams factory at 4242 West Fillmore Street looming in the background. Despite his civic pride, George simply couldn't avoid paying tribute to Second City's arch rival, the financial, communications, and entertainment capital of the world at the time, in this fantastic dreamscape set against the skyscrapers of Gotham. I'll take Manhattan, more of everything you can imagine. Money, money everywhere to dance and dine and drink. The Copa, Stork Club, and 21. Martinis? Fine, but make mine Manhattan. Filled to the brim with somebodies, pugs and pals and princesses, all much bigger than life, six-foot names and lights, monuments and magic. Where shall we play tonight? This scene echoes the big-budget musicals of Broadway and Hollywood, a towering Melanton tribute to a city officially closed to pinball from December 1941 under LaGuardia until June of 1976. This spectacular artwork adorned a March 1948 game, which had the distinction of being the last United pinball machine to be made without flippers. George later reprised this masterpiece on an equally spectacular glass for United's Manhattan Bingo in April of 1955. Here's my personal tribute to George Melanton and to Manhattan. It appeared in one of the 20 floor-to-ceiling glass display cases in New York City's Park Avenue atrium, which hosted Remember Pinball, a three-month retrospective of my personal collection of pinball machines and memorabilia. In addition to United's Manhattan, the display contains a large photo of George, hard at work at his drafting table, and a copy of the original catalog from the Canadian Tilt Exhibition, the first ever exhibit of pinball as art. More on that later. Melanton was particularly adept at depicting the high life, and to borrow a phrase from Robin Leach, exposing the youthful male players to lifestyles of the rich and famous. Speaking of which, here we find an alluring group of cosmopolitan ladies shopping their way through one of Chicago's grand downtown department stores. Marshall Fields, Carson Perry Scott, with prices in the thousands, yet no one seems to care, fashion plates and fur, pillback hats and polo coats, shop for who they are. Club women run amok, no need for hubby's cash. We'll just ship it to them, COD. Melanton painted an idealized version of downtown shopping in the mid-20th century. Consumer goods were the gods of the 1950s, and the temples where they were worshipped were those cavernous downtown department stores. Ironically, those bastions of commerce were already in eclipse due to changing demographics in the inner cities and flight to the burgeoning suburbs. Soon, shopping malls, retail strips, and discounters would threaten the very existence of flagship department stores. The escalators would stop, the lights would flicker, then go out, and another American institution would pass quietly into history. In fact, George unwittingly served as a chronicler of much of traditional America about to change in dramatic ways. We saw this in Ragmop and just moments ago in COD. Here's another wonderful piece of vintage Americana and a portent of things to come. William's Four Corners from 1952. Here's a shot of its beautiful playfield, a near bingo with 15 trap holes. And take a look at the way George carried out this delightful rural scene on the game's cabinet, something you never saw in a Gottlieb game. And speaking of Gottlieb, this is Roy Parker's treatment of a similar country scene on the back glass of Daisy May from July of 1954. Returning to Four Corners' back glass for a moment, forced to choose between the two, it would be a difficult decision indeed. Just as our beautiful heroine on the back glass of Four Corners is at a crossroads where four roads converge in a sleepy rural village, so too is contemporary America. For Eisenhower's interstate highway system will soon begin construction, and the slow but certain process of obliterating small towns and villages from the itinerary of all but the most curious or eccentric traveler. Roadside stands, attractions, and concessions will close, increasing the isolation and cutting off the already meager source of income for many a small town merchant. Thousands of identical concrete and asphalt ribbons will level our great land, displacing local character and enterprise for a national obsession with speed and what passes for progress. But the future, as Melanton saw it, was not all gloom and doom. For take a look at William's February 1954 Skyway. Don't keep us waiting. Join us in the future. It's a World's Fair, Ming's Mongo, and Autorama all rolled into one. We've got spaceships and flying saucers right here in River City. We commute to work by metrocopter and jet back home on water scooters. Gas stations? Forget it, Ace. Cars are history. Gas jockeys are out. Aerotech specialists are in. Dig? This is yesterday's vision of tomorrow. Melanton's 1954 dreamscape of the city of the future, every bit as compelling as Parker's work on Genco's October 1940 Metro. America's obsession with space travel, rocketry, and the whole fantastic realm of futurism was everywhere evident during the 1950s. Space shows dominated early children's TV. Baby boomers were mesmerized by Flash Gordon and Buck Rogers. The movie serials from the 30s, featuring Olympic swimmer turned actor Buster Crabbe in both of the title roles. Astral geometry informed the architecture. Harley Earl's Cadillacs looked like earthbound rockets. And George somehow managed to mirror it all in this upbeat tribute to the way we would be. You've seen a number of Melanton girls in George's artwork, but let's look at a few more before we close. This is William's Pinky from 1950. Judging from the theater marquee in the background, very likely based on the 1949 movie Pinky, starring Jean Crane in the title role as Patricia Pinky Johnson, a light-skinned black woman who lived as a white woman. Here's a bathing beauty, generic enough for any early 50s pinball player, William's sweetheart from May 1950. Whether her suitor was short, tall, handsome, ugly, suave, or stammering, no matter. George's candy store sweetheart was kind and attentive to any guy with a buffalo nickel. In the best pinball tradition, she recalls many of the solitary pinups who graced the glasses of games from the late 30s. This glass is one of very few, excepting those with football themes, where the setting is a college campus. Both co-eds in the foreground of William's September 1949 freshie flash us seductive smiles as we find them back on the quad for fall semester at what appears to be Northwestern University in Evanston, Illinois. In this final Melanton glass, duplication multiplies our enjoyment by a factor of nine. Nine Sisters, that is, by Williams in December of 1953. It's impossible to view this glass without wondering who they were, these three sets of great-looking great-looking twins. But I'll venture a guess. They might just be the Andrews sisters, the McGuire sisters, and the Fontaine sisters, three girl groups from the big band era who were still popular at this time. I hope my retrospective has given you some insight and a greater appreciation for the work of my late friend George Melanton. Not bad for a guy who got his first artistic break hand-painting flowers on shirts, and a far cry from the first 4-inch glass he did for Exhibit Supply during the Depression 30s. More than 20 years ago, Steve Young and I delivered an earlier presentation on the artwork of George Melanton to the 4th Chicago Pinball Expo in 1988. At the conclusion, without prompting, former Gottlieb executive and son of the firm's founder, Alvin Gottlieb, asked to say a few words about George Melanton. Mind you now, while George was the art director at Ad Posters, he never personally did any of Gottlieb's artwork. That job fell to Leroy Parker. Nonetheless, Alvin Gottlieb felt compelled to offer this tribute to George. It seems fitting to end this presentation of George's artwork with Alvin's words, and I now quote, "I've had the pleasure of being able to work with George many, many, many years, and with Leroy Parker. And when I saw this occasion coming up that displayed artwork by George, I just couldn't miss the opportunity to come down here and say what I'm going to say now. I have on many occasions said what a great bunch of people we have in the coin machine business. And more specifically, Leroy Parker and George Melanton had a job that was without comparison. Because when they were called in to do a job and given the work, some of the tasks looked like impossibilities. What you saw in this presentation were a lot of backglasses, which I would have to say, compared to the play fields, were relatively easy to do. These guys were given playboards to put artwork on that had to fit around all the components and display all the features, as well as the value of those features on every game. It was simply unbelievable how much work they had to put in to do it. And what I really wanted to say is that one of the nicest guys ever to do this work was George Melanton." Now returning for just a moment to my Gordon Hasse persona, I want to thank you for giving me the opportunity to share some of George's artwork with you. And time permitting, I'd quickly like to share with you a few special slides from the very first exhibit of Pinball as Art, which toured across Canada during 1974 and 1975. The show was conceived by Pat McCarthy and curated by my good friend Wayne Morgan. The slides you're about to see were taken on the opening night of the show at the Dunlop Art Gallery of the Regina Public Library in Saskatchewan, Canada, which was the first of six venues where the show was mounted. The show featured 23 fully functioning pinball machines from 1932 through 1955, in addition to 10 displayed playfields and a dozen backglasses. The assemblage of complete and restored machines during this primordial stage of collecting is nothing short of staggering. Complete games included Gottlieb's 1932 five-star final, Bally's 1933 Airway, Mills' 1934 Cannon Fire, Pacific Amusement's 1935 Baby Light Align, Bally's 1935 Prospector and 1937 Skipper, Genco's 1947 Stop and Go, United's 1948 Paradise, Gottlieb's 1950 Knockout, 51 Rose Bowl, 52 Happy Days, Skill Pool, and Queen of Hearts, Williams' 52 Four Corners and 53 Times Square, Gottlieb's 53 Shindig, 54 Double Coin, Mystic Marvel, Jockey Club, Dragonette, and Gold Star, and finally, Gottlieb's 1950 Gypsy Queen and Wishing Well. All of them, as previously stated, restored and playable. The template and archetype for today's Pinball Expo and the Pacific Pinball Museum, and all of it mounted 35 years ago. Absolutely unbelievable. I apologize for the darkness of the slides lent to me, especially for this occasion, by Wayne Morgan. but at least this seminal event was recorded for posterity. Here we find one of the museum's docents in the quiet time just minutes before the gallery opens to the public. Sharp eyes might be able to recognize Gottlieb's October 51 Rose Bowl at the far left. Here's a shot of patrons rushing into the exhibit hall on opening night. Some of them had been waiting in line literally for hours. Here's a crowd shot of eager viewers and players. Note the Mills July 1934 cannon fire in the foreground. In the subdued light of the museum, the playfield of Gottlieb's March 1954 mystic marvel projects kind of an eerie glow. And as the frantic crush of the first night's activity comes to a close, a few stragglers are reluctant to part ways with this newly validated form of both static and kinetic artwork. Note Happy Days on the left at the end of the row. Gottlieb's Jockey Club and Mystic Marble cabinets are partially visible here. And Happy Days visible again as the curtain comes down on the opening night's preview. In closing, I'd simply like to say that the great work being done by the PPM board and all the other pinball folks who have given so generously their time, talents, and efforts is both unparalleled and unprecedented in my personal experience. It will help to spread our collective passion to hundreds of thousands and to elevate pinball to the position it richly deserves as both an American icon and a celebration of art, technology, design, and plain and simple Yankee ingenuity. So folks, enjoy the expo, then go forth and spread the PPM gospel.
Thank you very much.
Yeah. Folks, if you have any questions, I'd be more than happy to try to address them. Yes, sir.
Did Mr. Blanton have any female models, or was this all from his imagination?
To my knowledge, both George and Leroy Parker did a lot of what we call in the advertising business swipe. They would see work of other artists in magazines of the time, and they wouldn't literally trace it out, but they would use it as kind of a template for their work. But they certainly both had a firm grasp of anatomy and how to draw the human figure. But I've found visual references in the past in some magazines from that period that are very close to representations that appeared on some of their back glasses. Yes, sir.
I've heard more than once that Leroy Parker had a personal hobby of doing portraits of clowns, I think maybe oil paintings. Did George Valentin have anything where he would do artworks that were not destined for the back glass or the play field that...
I can't answer that definitively, Dan. I know that two things I can tell you about work that George did. He did quite a few posters during WW2. He also was a huge fan of sailing, owned his own beautiful sloop. And if I had to guess, I'd say he probably did some artwork that had nautical themes to it.
Some of Linton back glasses. Williams that reflects sailing at a particular extra value to
him. I'm sure he paid extra special attention to those scenes, yeah. You kind of saw it in Wisconsin, although those were speedboats rather than the more graceful sloops that George was into. Regatta, yeah, good example, excellent example. Very good. Yes, sir?
Have you seen examples, because I heard both of those gentlemen did work during World War II for the war effort and made posters. I've never seen a picture of any of that. Have you seen any?
None that I could identify. I'm taking, or what I'm relating to you is based on conversations that I had with George. And he and Leroy Parker were actually quite close. They socialized together from time to time. George was a pallbearer at Leroy Parker's funeral. And what was told to me by George when he was still living was that both of them had done that kind of work. But in terms of being able to identify a specific piece and say that was done by one or the other of those two gentlemen, I wouldn't be able to do that.
Some of those great posters that we've seen, I've never seen like who they're identified by, but you know, the girls in a men's uniform.
Yeah, yeah.
Wax the waves and all that. Those girls looked like.
I wouldn't be at all surprised, because I know both of them worked for the war effort. No, none of that was signed. Yeah, Michael.
When did George get involved with advertising posters? Because didn't he work for Rockola?
He started out with Rockola, and George had a very interesting story. Despite the fact that he was the art director at Advertising Posters, he was never an employee. He was always a freelancer. And it was, you know, he would do a piece of work and he would turn it in, it would be accepted, and he'd receive a check for it. But he was self-employed the entire time, yet he carried the title of the art director of that firm. But I believe, I'd have to go back and look at my notes, Michael. I forget when he actually joined Ad Posters.
He hired other artists.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. Christian Marsh and folks like that worked for George, as did Leroy Parker. Leroy Parker, once he left Reproductions after the fire that they had there, worked for George Melenton, even though he was doing the Gottlieb work and George Melenton was doing everybody else's. Larry.
Between Roy Parker's more cartoonish, Norman Rockwell type work and George Melenton's straight lines and sort of plain faces with less detail, it's very reminiscent of fashion.
Absolutely.
Did George Melenton have a career or any experience at all in fashion?
Not that I'm aware of, no. Nope.
His women looked just so finely dressed all the time.
Well, I literally think his inspiration was the Vogue's magazine of the time or Harper's Bazaar. His stuff had a very upscale look, which probably, in my judgment anyway, worked to the detriment of Williams at times, because I think the stuff was just a little too highbrow for the audience that it was supposed to be appealing to. You know, today as a quote-unquote mature adult, I look at it and I say it's just wonderful. It's beautifully rendered. It's classy. But whether or not it had the appeal that the more overt style that Parker had with his buxom women and very much in the, you know, Terry and the Pirates tradition, I don't know. Yeah.
How has the artwork been attributed to the artist?
How? Fortunately, many of the folks that worked in the industry, even from the earliest days, were with us until quite recently. So most of that knowledge has come to us by being able to talk to people like George, like Alvin Gottlieb. And a lot of it is pretty intuitive, because once you get a good sense of what a Parker backlash looks like or a Melenton backlash looks like, you can pretty much attribute them with a high degree of success. I mean, you can look back at a Metro and know that that was a Roy Parker glass way back in the 30s because of the way the numerals were made, his particular kind of technique. But most of it, at least of the better-known artists, is pretty clearly identified. Yes?
How did they work out the themes? Was this a collaboration between artists and management?
From what I understand, during the Golden Age, when David Gottlieb was still living, the founder and patriarch of D. Gottlieb & Company, he had a great influence upon the theming of the games, and he worked very closely with Parker. I've been privileged to see some of the sketchbooks or the sketches that were done by Wayne Nyans for many of his 50s games. And Wayne always had a working title on the game, but that working title almost never ended up on the finished game. David had a large measure of influence in terms of naming the game and then directing the artist to a certain theme. Someone earlier mentioned, Dan mentioned, the fact that Parker did a lot of clowns. Well, one of the reasons he did a lot of clowns was that David Gottlieb love clowns. There was a huge clown portrait that hung in David Gottlieb's office, done at the behest by Leroy Parker. And you also see clowns in a lot of Gottlieb games from the 50s that seem totally out of place and inappropriate. But Parker loved clowns. But I guess the short answer to your question is, yes, it was a collaborative process. I'm not certain how it worked with Melanton and Williams and his relationship with United and Bally and everybody else, but there was a heavy influence, at least from Gottlieb, from the head man himself. Yeah.
Any last thoughts?
Only to say that I appreciate this great turnout. I hope that you folks have found this to be of interest. I'm delighted to have been able to play a part in advancing the interests of the Pacific Pinball Museum. What we need are proselytizers. We need each and every one of you to go out and tell other folks about what this wonderful group of people are doing. If you're well-heeled and have the inclination, we'd love to see the color of your money. If you have games that aren't being used that you'd like to put to good use and at the same time receive a tax benefit, there's ample opportunity for that to happen. As Larry and Michael said earlier, there are all sorts of opportunities for volunteerism to help these guys pull this off. It will never, ever be done by the highbrow museums of the world. They don't understand it. They never will. So if we want to see it done, it's going to have to be done by us. And I encourage you to do everything within your capability to help us advance the case and make this long-held dream a reality. Thanks again.